All right, we got a special guest in the studio with us, very timely, and I want to thank Brother Brian Quoba for coming into the studios today. He is going to be talking about Hubert Henry Harrison, and this is fun because we had a whole segment on Garveyism, and we didn't intersect with Harrison enough, so I'm looking forward to this conversation. Brian Quoba is a doctoral student in African-American history. He's also a researcher whose research focuses on the black activist, journalist, educator, orator, bibliophile, and unsung father of Harlem radicalism, Hubert Henry Harrison. Brian has taught U.S. and world history in primary and secondary schools, and he has been an activist on issues ranging from Palestine to LGBT equality for over 10 years. He is the founder and chair of the Oxford Pan-African Forum and an organizing member of hashtag Roads Must Fall Oxford. All right, just start with that for a second. What is the hashtag Roads Must Fall?
So Roads Must Fall, well, first of all, thanks so much, Dr. Haight, for having me on the program. It's really a pleasure to be here. I've been following I Mix What I Like for a couple months now, and it's great. It's great to be here. So Roads Must Fall is the name of a movement that started initially actually in South Africa at the University of Cape Town, in which black students basically organized to decolonize education and started marching and protesting the statue of Cecil Rhodes, which used to sit right in the center of the entrance to the University of Cape Town. Cecil Rhodes, of course, being perhaps the most recognizable symbol of European colonialism in history. Rhodes was, you know, a British Oxford-trained businessman, mining magnate who expropriated lands both in South Africa and in northern and southern Rhodesia, what are now Zambia and Zimbabwe, Rhodesia being named for Cecil Rhodes. And so they protested this statue. They protested the lack of African-centered curriculum in their disciplines and studies. They protested the lack of black academics. And they eventually forced the university to actually remove the statue of Cecil Rhodes as part of a whole longer list of demands that they brought to the administration. And so we in Oxford, seeing this movement unfold in South Africa, not only at UCT, but it kind of spread to other campuses, decided to show solidarity by organizing, or beginning to organize, I'll say, a Rhodes Must Fall movement in Oxford, given that Cecil Rhodes was an Oxford alumnus. The Rhodes Scholarship is based in Oxford. There's a huge Rhodes House, so literally a structure that pays homage to this notorious white supremacist, colonialist, and imperial exploiter of Southern African people. So that's what Rhodes Must Fall in Oxford is about. It's a sort of sister movement, you could say, to the struggle to decolonize education in South Africa.
And have there been, this is going to be a very inflammatory question, pun intended, but have there been any attempts to, like, just burn the house down? Like, you know, hashtag is good, but hashtags work well, too. Right?
Yeah, we have begun discussions about what to do with various symbols of colonial violence and imperialism in Oxford, because, as you know, Britain is, you know, was a massive imperial power, and in Oxford there's many symbols, not just the Rhodes House, but there's the Codrington Library, for example, named for Christopher Codrington, who was a slave owner and plantation owner in Barbados, and whose wealth, exploited from the labor of enslaved Africans in the Caribbean, went to endow this library. So we have taken a nonviolent approach thus far. Our movement is quite young and quite new, and I think the discussions about what to do with all these symbols and sort of iconographies of colonial violence are an important conversation, to which we want to add, you know, discussions of curriculum and making a less Eurocentric curriculum, discussions of representation of, you know, black academics and non-Western and non-male academics and students having a broader kind of representation as well. So it's all part of that mix, and we're excited to be entering a new school year and seeing more things unfold.
All right. So let's get straight into Hubert Henry Harrison then. Mm-hmm. What brought you and led you to engage him as a subject of interest and a scholar that's rarely talked about? What made you say this? He needs more attention in the world.
Well, I think Harrison's case is unique because he had many experiences, some of which I feel like I've had. For example, he started out in the Socialist Party, which was kind of a white leftist organization who he tried to push on the race question and on organizing black workers and reaching out to the black community. Initially they supported him, but pretty quickly they kind of swept that project under the rug. And he was also more radical than them on other issues like labor organizing, and so on. And so he had to part ways with the Socialist Party and kind of do his own thing. So I had a similar experience in a group, where I tried to push it to do new things and it wouldn't budge, and so I had to leave. And so things like that, I began to see echoes of certain experiences I've had as an organizer, as an activist, with experiences Harrison had. And then reading Jeff Perry's book was really sort of what introduced me to Harrison, I think, on a deeper level. Perry being, an independent scholar who's written the first of a two-volume biography of Harrison. So looking at that and sort of thinking about my own experiences are what really got me initially excited in learning more about Harrison.
And what stage are you at now? Because you're a doctoral student. Mm-hmm. What stage are you at in writing on Harrison? And what do you hope to bring out that'll be, that scholarly contribution from mm-hmm. your analysis? Because mm-hmm. Jeff Perry's a white socialist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm imagining, given your experiences with white socialists, you'll bring a different African-centered or Pan-African approach to Hubert Henry Harrison, where he mm-hmm. fits and doesn't fit in some of these circles. What do you think is your direction?
Yeah, well, I think that, I'm sort of looking at a couple of different themes in my research that Harrison sheds light on or made contributions to. So, and by the way, I'll just say that I'm greatly indebted to Perry for, helping to revive our understanding and sort of bring Harrison to a wider audience. He's done a lot of work, meeting with the Harrison family, getting Harrison's papers, getting them into the public, spotlight. He edited a volume of Harrison's writings and so on. So I really want to thank, and give a shout out to Perry for that. But as you said, I have a slightly different maybe emphasis with Harrison, in the sense that I am interested in his experience with the white left, but I'm more interested in kind of where he went afterwards, mm-hmm. because I think that he was very much shaped by this sense that white radicals were white before radical, in the sense that white supremacy as a structural problem transcended the white community's political spectrum. It wasn't just conservatives or liberals. It was even the socialists and the so-called radicals who perpetuated these notions that basically white workers were the focus of everything, and the black community was, or what they used to call the Negro problem, was kind of a secondary at best issue. So Harrison, after he leaves the white left Socialist Party, becomes basically one of the sort of founding pioneers of the New Negro Movement in Harlem. And in 1917, for example, he organized the Liberty League of Negro Americans, which was basically kind of the first Harlem-based organization of this New Negro Movement, which was kind of a movement of self-empowerment and black awakening across the country and even globally, but certainly in Harlem, which was then considered kind of the mecca in many ways for the black community in terms of culture, in terms of politics. And he also founded a newspaper called The Voice, which was essentially the first in what became a long line of radical black presses, followed by The Messenger of A. Philip Randolph and Chandler Owen, Negro World of the Garvey Movement, The Emancipator, and other sort of radical black publications at the time. But Harrison's Voice was really the first one and kind of set the tone in many ways for a lot of the both black consciousness, but also, as you were saying, African sort of consciousness. And Harrison was deeply sort of versed in African history and African civilizations in his time in the 1910s and 20s, and certainly did a lot of work to promote African consciousness in Harlem. So yeah, there's a lot we could talk about, but those are some of the things that I'm looking at in my research, because I think that, you know, these are very important aspects of what Harrison brought. When you think of somebody like you know, John Henry Clark, who came to Harlem initially from the South because he read an article by Schomburg, Arturo Schomburg, who was Afro-Puerto Rican, good friend of Hubert Harrison's, and who, you know, was part of that milieu that was helping to bring this kind of consciousness to Harlem. So we see that kind of lineage as well, as far as some of our great scholars and thinkers who came out of that context.
Now, one of the things we like about Harrison is that he was incredibly prescient, and you can read in When Africa Awakes that he's describing what people will eventually remember about W.B. Du Bois. Now, at the time, he's talking about how Du Bois is supporting World War I, and he's a traitor to Negroes, and he's working for the U.S. government, and he has a line where he says something like, history and people will probably remember him as some great historian or scholar, but we know him today as like a florid essay writer. He's an essayist, the storyteller, right? And so he kind of details what some of the betrayals of the black communities that Du Bois was engaged in, essentially working as an agent with Spingarn at the time. And you read that, and it's almost like you're shocked, because you think about the Du Bois that comes later. But at the time, Du Bois was in support of World War I, and then I'm reading in one of the essays on Black Agenda Report by an author whose name escapes me, but they cover a dissertation that talked about black supporters of the eugenics movement. And that was just wild reading for me, like Howard University being the epicenter of black education for the quote-unquote talented 10th, as Du Bois would once upon a time talk about, had folks like E. Everett Just and Du Bois himself, is described in the dissertation as supporting racial eugenics, wanting to breed out black pathology, right? So talk about Harrison as like the combatant intellectual who is fighting for the rights of black people against the so-called scholars at the time who were working to undermine black movements and sovereignty.
Yeah, well, Harrison, as you pointed out, he played a very decisive role in exposing the fact that Du Bois, as part of his, as a consequence of, or related to his supporting World War I, had applied to become a captain in military intelligence in order to spy on black radicals during the war and monitor Negro subversion, essentially. And, you know, in part because of Harrison's exposing that through his newspaper, The Voice, and then others, you know, William Monroe Trotter of The Guardian in Boston, and other, you know, the Amsterdam News, the black press caught on to it pretty quickly. It really weakened Du Bois' stature. It aborted the government's interest in having him as a captain, because they realized that it would destroy his stature in the black community. And it was certainly a low point in Du Bois' career politically, something he actually, you know, was upset about for years and years and years afterwards. And Du Bois, you know, he had a big ego, so I think it was hard for him, even in retrospect, to admit that he had made a mistake in supporting the war. But, you know, he did, and you know, Harrison was somebody who was very active even during the war, at a time when people could be deported or jailed for speaking against the war. Harrison was part of a project called the Liberty Congress in 1918 in July. William Monroe Trotter of Boston organized this nationwide gathering. It was over 100 delegates from 33 different states that met in Washington. And Hubert Harrison was elected chairman of the Liberty Congress. And this was a body which put a petition to the federal government against lynching and segregation and disfranchisement, which was the exact opposite of what Du Bois was saying at the time. Du Bois was saying, let's forget our special grievances and close ranks to support the war effort. And Harrison and other new Negro movement activists and radicals were saying, no, the war, this so-called war for democracy, is a perfect time to remember our grievances and to press for them. Let's press for not just making Europe so-called democratic or safe for democracy. Let's make the South safe for democracy. Let's make Georgia and Tennessee and Mississippi safe for democracy. If Wilson, President Wilson, who was the president at the time, if he wants to say this is about democracy, well, let's hold him to his word. And that was actually a clever way that they were able to avoid deportation and jail and so on by just using that kind of patriotic framework in order to advance a black agenda, essentially. And it's funny because in retrospect, you know, Harrison comments in the book you mentioned, When Africa Awakes, he comments about how they kind of had to put on this show during that time because of the repression and the censorship. You know, the government was monitoring newspapers and the black press quite intently to try to make sure that discontent didn't boil over. And Harrison talks about, you know, using the language of democracy, even though they knew that it was bogus, and they knew that it was just a kind of justification for the U.S. entering the war. And so it's a really interesting period in Harrison's life, because it's a good example of how there were alternatives to the sort of Du Bois approach of just patriotism and blind support for the war. And when you look into that history, I've just found it to be much richer than we often get when the debate is framed as, you know, Du Bois versus the Booker T. Washington, you know, Tuskegee School, or those kinds of things.
Okay. But we got a few minutes left on this end of I Mix What I Like. We're going to run until about 10:55, and you're welcome to stay for Community Watch and comment, talk shop with our callers. Mm. But I like the antagonisms of the Du Bois verses, so I want to stay there for a second, because most people associate the New Negro Movement with folks like Alain Locke. And there's arguments on who gave you that first, and the Garveyites will say we were talking New Negro before Negroes knew they were new. where do you sit in on this argument with Hubert Henry Harrison and the New Negro Movement? Were they before Alain Locke? Is it the Harlem Renaissance has been miscast for the Howardites? No offense to Howardites, but if you take it, shots fired. Let's go. So where do you fit in on that one?
Yeah, well, it's true that Locke is kind of given credit for the New Negro thing because of his 1925 anthology called The New Negro, which brought together a whole number of, you know, cultural producers, artists, writers into this edited volume. But in fact, 6 years prior, Hubert Harrison was editing a magazine called The New Negro.
What?
In 1919.
Ben did that. 1919.
That's right.
This is deep. Let's go.
Yeah, and as far as Garvey is concerned, Harrison actually, it was Harrison's Liberty League that he organized in Harlem, the thing I mentioned in 1917, when Garvey, after he came to the U.S. first in 1916, I believe it was. And he literally, when he first spoke in Harlem, he actually fell on his face. Literally, he got so nervous that he stepped off the stage and fell flat on his face. And so that didn't go over well. But he ended up touring in different places across the country. And he came back to Harlem in 1917 and spoke at this historic Liberty League meeting, the inaugural meeting of Harrison's Liberty League. That's the platform on which Garvey really launched his career in Harlem, and all the contemporary accounts from the radicals of that period describe how, you know, Garvey really, you know, he had sort of honed his craft as an orator and a speaker, and he now was kind of coming into his own and blossoming based on having that platform. It was about 2,000 people that Harrison had organized. And it's interesting because Harrison actually supported Garvey initially and even became an editor of the Negro World in 1920. And so for a while, for about a year or two, Harrison is a dues-paying member of the United Negro Improvement Association and the Garvey movement. He's editing the Negro World newspaper, redesigns it, makes it more appealing, and into really kind of the premier black paper of the time. But at the same time, Harrison's developing this critique of Garvey and beginning to see from behind the scenes sort of how Garvey operates and some of the things that he's saying that aren't matching what's actually going on the ground. For example, you know, Garvey at the first convention of the UNIA in 1920, Garvey's saying, oh, we had 20,000 or 25,000 delegates. And actually, you know, Harrison counts 100 delegates when they're voting for different positions. And he notes that Garvey is electioneering and sort of really running with an iron hand his candidates to get elected into all the positions and stuff. So it was a much smaller affair than, unfortunately, many of the historians have spoken to. But it's one example of kind of the magnanimous, overblown character that Garvey had, and his sort of egomania, if you want to sort of use a phrase like that, that Harrison could see from the inside and was quite critical of, and ended up leaving the Garvey movement in part because he just felt like there wasn't space for anybody who didn't want to toe Garvey's line, essentially.
All right, this is tough conversation. My Garveyites about to flip call on the next show. Let's hold there. We're here with Brian Quovo. We want to thank you very much for joining us with I Mix What I Like, and you can check this out at imixwhatilike.org for this conversation and more from what you heard earlier today with Jared Ball and Glenn Ford. But we want to stop here and take this pause, and as Dr. Ball would say, we'll see you in the whirlwind. Especially if we're talking about Garvey right now. Peace, if you're willing to fight for it, as Fred Hampton used to say. Red Eagle's going to take us out. Red Eagle, thank you very much for your work this morning. We're going to come right back with Community Watch and Comment, continue this conversation with Brian Quoba, and hear your stories of the week and the week stories that you don't want to talk about. Thank you very much. Dr. Haight, we'll be right back.